given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what... It's unbelievable. And especially they open this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment from different people, pursued me. They published my phone number, all my private information. They even published an address of a flat that where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding. The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The recent decision by Moscow to cut its gas supply to Rome by 15%, which was announced by fuel giant Eni earlier this week, did not catch the Mario Draghi's government off guard, albeit consumer confidence in Italy is at its lowest level in over 20 years. On Saturday, Italy's ecological transition minister Roberto Cingolani said he remains confident that filling underground gas storage to 90% by winter, a requirement recently adopted by the Council of the European Union to strengthen the bloc's energy security, is still a feasible target. However, Minister Cingolani argued he expects prices to further surge, particularly after a temporary closure of the Nord Stream pipeline for maintenance.
We are definitely concerned over our gas supplies. Having said that, underground gas storage on our territory has been filled to almost 60%. So, let me tell you, we are doing fine in that respect.
Italy is trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for 40% of total gas imports. That's while prices in the country were 8% higher in June than a year earlier, marking the highest one-month increase in prices since 1986. The energy crisis has been compounded by an unprecedented drought that is sweeping through Italy's northern and central regions. Experts have warned the drought will reduce the country's hydropower output by 60% by the end of this year.
The problems are multiple, and we will not only face the energy crunch and the water shortage, but also the financial turmoil that will inevitably hit the international markets. Let's sit tight, because a financial shock is on the way, and it will start from the US as usual.
Lately, Prime Minister Draghi has been facing problems protecting the government coalition that supports him. A rift has opened up with former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Also, former Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini has reportedly taken up arms against the executive. A government collapse at this very stage could have grave repercussions for Italy's social stability. Max Civili, Rome.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. They discussed cooperation relations in which Assad described ties between both states as an alliance of will in the face of Western hegemony. During the meeting, the Syrian president touched upon the threats of Turkey to launch a new offensive in Syria. Assad said Turkish pretexts for an aggression on Syria are false, misleading and disconnected from reality, stressing that they violate the UN Charter and international law. Amir Abdullahian said Assad's recent visit to Tehran constituted a turning point in Syrian-Iranian relations. He added that Israeli attacks on Syria are part of the terrorist war on the country. The top Iranian official noted that Iran is ready to help settle misunderstandings between Damascus and Ankara.
Any foreign intervention in Syria complicates the situation. We understand Turkish concerns over border issues. The solution lies in dialogue between Syrian and Turkish security officials. I understand from my talks with the Turks that they prioritize a political solution.
Amir Abdullahian also had a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. He expressed optimism over solving the Turkish-Syrian conflict peacefully, asserting Iran will exert all efforts to prevent any conflict in Syria. Maqdad welcomed Iran's efforts.
Any solution that leads to Turkey's retreat from Syrian territories, stopping its attacks on the country, and ending Turkey's support to terrorist groups is welcomed. We trust the Islamic Republic of Iran, but not the other side.
Maqdad reiterated Syria's determination to eliminate terrorism and thanked Iran for its support. He stressed that Israel must realize that Syria will not remain silent over Israeli aggressions. The visit shows the depth of ties between the two allies and the crucial role Iran plays in the region, as it comes hours after an Israeli attack on Syria and amid speculations that Turkey is going to launch a military operation in the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The town of Alamskia. 8 years of war have left their mark. The streets are eerily deserted as the front line is close. The cultural center was hit a few days ago. It now serves as a town hall. From inside, I am pointed out a Russian monument. While I'm filming the boom of outgoing artillery, two people were killed at the monument this week. The building, like the streets outside, feels like a ghost town. But inside, I find Elena, the head of the council administration.
People run quickly to the shops, buy what they need, and run home. People are simply afraid of going out. I can't say how people live in the west of Ukraine, but this is how we live here. We hope for peace soon, so we can start to rebuild the town.
The school has been hit many times, as is the market and the hospital.
Now, while elsewhere in Ukraine, it's very easy to level the accusations that Ukraine is shelling civilians and civilian areas, here in this town, it's a little bit harder to do so because, frankly, the front line is only around 50 meters or 100 meters around this town, and there's the almost constant sound of outgoing artillery as well. So Ukrainians may well just be trying to hit these artillery pieces rather than just aiming at civilians.
Incredibly, in this desolate place, some civilians still live here, although most cower inside.
So what is it like to live here?
It's bad, my nerves are shredded and it's always tense. What kind of a state is Ukraine that kills its own people, sending brother against brother? We are hoping soon for victory.
In the adjacent city of Golovka, I meet the well-known mayor, Ivan Prokhodko. He uses a Ukrainian flag as the doormat to his office.
This flag lying over there symbolizes the criminal state of Ukraine, not its people. The flag is my personal trophy as well. I took it at the front line. I was born in Donetsk and I loved Ukraine. But those who took power in 2014 in the coup trampled over democracy and they do not care about the citizens of the East.
Who do you blame for the breakup of Ukraine?
The answer is obvious. NATO countries are to blame, in particular the United States. They needed Ukraine as a hotbed of tension at the border with Russia. You see, I'm for democracy. In 2014, they should have asked what people wanted. But nobody was interested in people's opinion. That's why we have got what we have now. We have a terrible war, dead Ukrainians, dead Russians. It's really horrible. And those who draw benefit from it are sitting across the ocean.
While Russia calls this war a special military operation, Ukraine calls it an invasion. But here in Donbass, the pro-Russian civilians call it a liberation operation. With the Russian army making gains not far to the north of these desperate streets, the 8 years of war in this town might finally be set to end. Jenny Milik-Golovka.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. plenty in my state through lawful provision, and that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security, and placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A Bank of England report warning the economic outlook for the UK and the rest of the world has deteriorated materially. It calls the British economy very uncertain. British households have been paying more for energy, food and fuel recently, mainly due to the economic fallout of the Ukraine war. Now, experts believe that the inflation rate in Britain could surpass 11% later this year. Elsewhere in Europe, powerhouse Germany posting a monthly trade deficit for the first time in three decades. Germany's Federation of Trade Unions has warned that the short supply can lead to the collapse of entire industries if it remains unresolved. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najafi. We're going to discuss the fallout of the Ukraine war in Europe. Joining me in this episode will be historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling in Bristol. Also with us will be journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich in Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Tony, beginning with you, to what extent has the Ukraine war contributed to rising energy prices and the cost of living crisis in Europe?
Well, I can't really speak for Europe. I can certainly speak for the UK. And I'm not so sure that the Ukraine war has contributed much. What has contributed is the excessive, relentless sanctions being piled on Russia from the West. And this has made, obviously, a big difference in confidence. So as soon as you get a government saying, oh, we're not going to be trading with this part of the world, what happens is it has a knock-on effect on all your various businesses, not just the lack of actual trade, because, of course, there is still trade going on between Russia and Europe in terms of the fuel, which is still going, the gas, which is still going. These are the major things. I think what's the main problem here is these new green taxes which they've been implementing at the same time. We were told here in the UK and across Europe and the United States back in the last autumn 2021, we were told there's going to be a big hike in gas prices and fuel prices, but we weren't told why. Now we know. And I would suggest that they knew that the conflict in Ukraine was going to break out way back in 2021. And that actually over Christmas, what we saw here was a new green tax. I would call it a fascist green tax, a green fascist tax put onto petrol and diesel here in Britain, an extra 20 pence a litre. What happened is the oil companies raised their prices before Christmas, and when the new tax came in over Christmas, they dropped their prices so that no one would notice the new tax. This is the BPs and the Shells doing this. And so this has, I think, been the main driver of inflation. And of course, this, what it does is it really makes it much more difficult for the small and medium businesses to survive. They're having to pay more and more just to get around. So if you put, I mean, this is one basic thing of economics which doesn't seem to have got through to the British politicians or the finance journalists in London, for obvious reasons, is that they don't like to upset the finance people in London, the journalists. It is that you, what you've done is you've increased everything. By increasing the price of fuel, you increase the price of almost everything. Goods, manufactured goods, services, food, all has to be distributed. So you're adding on to the price of that by increasing the cost of fuel. And I think that's the main driver behind this, rather than the actual Russian action. What they're trying to do, as they always do, is to blame somebody else for their own problems. I think the biggest question in all of this has got to be why these enormous sanctions have been put onto Russia, because of what was actually the Russian intervention in a civil war, which the NATO countries had been fueling for many years. Victoria Nuland in the United States pouring $5 billion into the coup in 2014, for example. She admitted to that herself. So there was a civil war which was started over in the Ukraine, and the attempt has been to blame all of the problems which are being put onto the West, domestic populations in Europe, the United States, and here in Britain, an attempt to blame this on Russia, because they simply will not admit that what they're doing is damaging their own people.
Okay. Now, John Bosnich, I just wanted to ask you about, let's take a look at the bigger picture. Let's see how this Ukraine war has impacted Europe as a whole. Then we'll come to Britain and then later on to Germany and others.
Okay, well, I mean, we know already, and I appreciate the comments of your other guest, Tony Gosling, because he's right on the money here. Every war is an opportunity to camouflage another domestic problem. And so this is correct. It's an opportunity for the English government and for European governments to blame Russia for unsolved infrastructure problems within their own economies. Mm-hmm. And no better than to blame it now on Russia than to have to try and explain to the public that you made a mistake yourselves. So that's a correct starting point. But on the longer term, what we're seeing here is that this war represents a shift in power globally. And this is the actual end of the line for the make war and take over countries approach that the United States, the so-called Anglo-American Empire, has been pursuing since Britannia ruled the waves. We have a situation here where there's either going to be devastating nuclear war, not two nuclear bombs like World War II, but a devastating nuclear war that's going to change the face of the planet, or there's going to be cooperation between nations in our common interest. And this has been forced upon us by the American push, with the support of England, with the support of London and the military regime there, and the military regime, and I call them both military regimes, because basically the number one business of the Anglo-American Empire is war. Everything else is just feeding the people while we prepare for the next war. This is the turning point. Are we going to pursue an economic plan for the world based on taking from other people or based on sharing technologies and working together for the future? That's where we are today.
Okay, interesting. Now, Tony, let's take a look at Britain now. The cost of living crisis, together with the rising inflation, is taking a heavy toll on the economy, as you know. And there is this new report that's painting an even darker picture for the country's economic situation. So what do you anticipate is awaiting British economy?
Well, the signs are not good. Of course, there will be an attempt to blame all this on Brexit, as the British economy has its problems. I've seen the people fighting back here. We saw just yesterday, in the beginning of July 2022, we saw lorry drivers blockading. What they're doing is they're driving very slowly along motorways. They're not actually making sure that nobody can move anywhere, that they're making the point by driving slowly together on all three lanes of the motorway, or two lanes together, that people are not going to put up with these fuel price hikes. And actually what's going on, of course, is what the oil cartels have been trying to do for many decades. Governments have been reining them back and trying to stop them doing this, which is simple. It's called price fixing. The fact is that the oil cartels have become so powerful, and actually they are some of the wealthiest businesses or in any institutions, in some ways more wealthy than governments. They've got more money to throw around than the governments do. Is that they're now using that power to do things like restrict the supply, as they did last autumn here in Britain. And so what's happening is there is a bit of a fight back going on from ordinary people getting together and telling the government that we know you've got a very powerful oil lobby. We are people and we are a lobby too. So listen to us. But the prospects are not good here in Britain or in other parts of Europe. And as you mentioned at the start, this is very shocking to see the Germans return their first for many, many years trade deficit. So that means that the Germans are importing more than they're exporting. Mm-hmm. Germany, let's not forget, is the manufacturing hub of Europe. So what we're seeing is the geopolitical plates shifting, tectonic plates completely changing. So the pattern that's been building up since the Second World War is now changing, a bit like something as important as the fall of the Berlin Wall. The prospects in Britain are not good, and I think we need to understand why that is. And the reason is because we have adopted this Anglo-Zionist Empire attitude of finance capitalism. That is to say, money rules the world, and the people with the money make all the decisions. They have the power to keep their money offshore, for example, so it doesn't get taxed, and they can accumulate more and more. And when they start to become billionaires, then they set up these foundations, tax-free foundations, so they can funnel the money into those and use those for political change and propaganda. Basically, think places like the Wellcome Trust, the Bill and Melinda, the finance sector needs to be very strongly regulated or owned. Things like water, also we have, telecommunication monopoly. These things need to be controlled by openly and publicly. And we're also talking gas and electricity industries. Countries like Russia and many others around, sovereign countries, going to keep control of these. And the person who's made this fight between finance capitalist countries and industrial has got to be the American economist Michael Hudson. By the way, he also Chinese universities too. So this is well understood, completely shut out by the London and by the finance journalists. Some point they will start getting educated on this, and then what we're fighting, because of course we are fighting this within Britain as well. We don't want taken over and controlled individuals. We want control and own them for them.
Okay, John, let's take a look at Germany now. The rare deficit in Germany is blamed on international supply chains and record energy prices, and this is said to be partially triggered by Russia's cutting back on supplying natural gas to Europe. And Germany relies on Russia for 35% of its natural gas needs. Let's have your take on that.
Well, I think that it is in part a fuel shortage issue, but these countries have strategic reserves, and the conflict in Ukraine has not been going on long enough to deplete the strategic reserves of Germany. So we have a more complex problem here than simply a supply and demand problem. What we have here is a general refocusing of the economic center of this planet. And this has been going on for some time now, but the economic motor force of this planet has already shifted to China. It is no longer Germany. Germany is still the motor center of the economy of Europe. And when Germany shows a deficit, that means that the entire Europe is going to be going down the tubes economically shortly. So those who wish to survive will be turning to China. they will be turning to China for cheaper quality, cheaper goods with similar quality. China will be able to outproduce Germany. China has already licensed large elements of German productive capacity. Germany has sold these licenses to China, and China has factories that have supply of fuel, a steady, stable supply of fuel from Russia directly by pipeline. And this is going to be the tipping factor that's going to tip the scales away from Europe as the center of the world. And it won't be so long, you know, our grandchildren, if not our children, will be looking at atlases of the world in which Europe is no longer the center. Europe will be on one edge, America and South America will be on the other edge, and the Eurasian landmass centering around Russia, India, and China will be at the center of every world map. This is just the start.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we talked about problems, Jim, and Tony, let's now take a look at actually ways that we could actually resort to address the economic woes in Europe. Slapping sanctions on top of sanctions on Moscow, which pushes Russia to take more tit-for-tat measures, is that the way?
Well, actually, Russia has been quite good in not taking tit-for-tat measures. They have done with their diplomats over the years, but the Russians are doing everything they can. They're bending over backwards to have decent relations with the West. You know, they have understood that that there's been 15,000 people killed in the Donbass region in Ukraine, which is why they felt it necessary to intervene over the last 8 years. And that aspect of this isn't really covered at all in the Western media. So the Russians, I think, have not been just taking one measure for another. They're seeing this as something where, okay, so if the West wants to play these games, and I think actually the West, by the way, if you want to look it up, is using game theory here, that what they're doing is they're saying, let's imagine having a war game about this and who can win and who can't. And what they're doing is they're following these ideas, economic warfare and military warfare games, in order to try and beat the Russians, almost like using a chess computer or something, this kind of thing. But at the end of the day, the populations are watching all of this, and they're seeing the credibility of the West slide down. So, I think that the Russians have been much more mature, and the Chinese, in many ways, just simply taking what the West has been trying to do without big retaliation. And that's because, of course, they are winning the economic war, if you want to see it like that. They have a very strong natural resource bases. They have a very good and efficient, well-regulated economy and manufacturing bases where individuals can actually get access to new people starting in the market. What we've got in the West is basically a series of rackets or cartels that are controlling industries, are price fixing. And, you know, this is really the way that big empires go down. And we're seeing that, of course, with the United States. Slowly but surely, countries around the world are realizing, well, we cannot trust putting our money into Washington or London because then it may well be seized. So that money is slowly but surely, and that wealth is moving around the world to these new power centers that John was talking about, away from Washington. And the Anglo-Zionist Empire is basically shooting itself in the foot by having such a ridiculous overreaction. That overreaction is aimed at its domestic population. But I don't think necessarily that propaganda is going to work in the long term. It's really a desperate measure, and I think it indicates just how desperate the deep state, the ruling elite in the West now is.
Okay, John, let me ask you a question about the U.S., and then if we have time, another. I'll put in a question to Tony about Europe. Now, President Biden blaming Russia for the rising fuel price in the U.S., and so far he's earmarked, you know, $7 billion of American taxpayer money, into aiding Ukraine fight Russia. Does he intend to see an end to this bloodshed and destruction that's happening in Ukraine and love life on both sides, or does he have another agenda on his mind?
Well, when all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And all America has now is a military. That's what they've got to offer to the world, military intervention. So they are hoping that by stacking the cards against Russia, by dumping their latest weapons into the hands of untrained Ukrainians, many of whom do not want to fight, they think that they can defeat the Russian army when it's come to right the wrongs after 8 straight years, as Tony mentioned, 8 straight mm-hmm. years of genocide against ethnic Russians in Ukraine. Well, they're absolutely wrong. And if the shoe were on the other foot, they would understand it. But nobody does to America what America does to the rest of the world. So they don't understand that when you're backed into a corner, when you're facing the prospect of nuclear weapons just minutes away from your capital city, when you've got the prospect of armies full of Nazis wearing World War II uniforms and swastikas at your borders, you have only one possible response, and that is to eliminate them. And that's what Russia is doing. And as Russia eliminates this forward front of the American military empire, they realize that where they are in those other countries, because of the same system that is failing America, failing the neo-Nazis in Ukraine, and failing the puppet comedian president every day in Ukraine. The Ukrainian people themselves are smarter than this, and they are going to stop it. They will probably remove Zelensky themselves.
Okay, Tony, we have almost 1 minute. If you could tell me briefly, would Europe be better off by further offering military and logistical aid to Kiev to keep fighting Russia, or rather by striving to encourage and facilitate dialogue between the two belligerent sides?
Well, look, of course, Europe would be far better off if we could see some sort of a peace deal in like the Minsk agreement in Ukraine. But it doesn't look as if the United States is going to allow Europe to do that, because, of course, we must understand that most of the force behind NATO is a United States force. Worth remembering, of course, that there were a couple of people involved, one specifically whose name escapes me. These are the leaders of NATO after the Second World War who had actually been in the SS during the war, Nazi leaders taking over as NATO leaders. So, of course, the Russians realize exactly who they're dealing with. But when it comes to what Europe should do, yes, of course, there should be a peace agreement. But I think many people in Britain are watching this battle going on a long way away and just wondering, what on earth does Boris Johnson think he's doing, trying to fight somebody else's war in another part of the world when he's leaving his own people struggling to even feed their children? This is a message which is going down here. And, of course, as I said, what we're seeing is more and more pushback, more and more people out on the streets and out on the roads actually protesting against this policy. So it may be that it's down to the British people to turn around this crazy government idea of carrying on with this war, because peace in Ukraine would mean a fantastic benefit for the whole of Europe, and that's afraid against the interests of the United States, and that's where we are. Europeans need to really get, I think, grow a pair and really start to stand up to the United States. We do not want, and we refuse to have, a U.S. war on European soil. Thank you very much, and we're not going to put up with that.
Okay, and that's all the time we have. Tony Gosling in Brussels, John Bosnich in Belgrade, thank you so much for the contribution and insight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. In the United States, former President Donald Trump has weathered scandals by keeping his intentions under wraps. But recent testimony paints a stark portrait of a man willing to do almost anything to hang on to power. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by the chief White House correspondent of the New York Times, Peter Baker. The piece is titled, New Insights into Trump's State of Mind on January 6th Chip Away at Doubts. He was not speaking metaphorically. It was not an offhand comment. President Donald Trump had every intention of joining a mob of supporters he knew to be armed and dangerous as it marched to the Capitol building in Washington. And there had even been talk of marching into the House chamber himself to disrupt Congress from ratifying his election defeat. For a year and a half, Donald Trump has been shielded by obfuscations and mischaracterizations, benefiting from uncertainty about what he was thinking on 6th of January 2021. If he truly believed the election had been stolen, if he genuinely expected the gathering at the Capitol would be a peaceful protest, the argument went, then could he be held accountable, much less indicted, for the mayhem that ensued? But for a man who famously avoids leaving emails or other trails of evidence of his unspoken motives, any doubts about what was really going through Mr. Trump's mind on that day of violence seem to have been eviscerated by testimony presented in recent weeks by the House committee investigating the Capitol attack, especially the dramatic appearance last week of a 26-year-old former White House aide who offered a chilling portrait of a president willing to do almost anything to hang on to power. More than perhaps any insider account that has emerged, the recollections of the aide, Cassidy Hutchinson, demolished the fiction of a president who had nothing to do with what happened. Each revelation was stunning on its own. Donald Trump knew what weapons were in the crowd as he exhorted supporters to fight like hell and even tried to stop anyone from disarming his supporters. He was so determined to join the mob at the Capitol that he lashed out at his Secret Service detail for refusing to take him. And he was so nonchalant about the bedlam he had unleashed that he suggested Vice President Mike Pence might deserve to be executed for refusing to overturn the election. But when added together, the various disclosures have produced the clearest picture yet of an unprecedented attempt to subvert the traditional American democratic process, with a sitting president who had lost at the ballot box planning to march with an armed crowd to the Capitol to block the transfer of power, brushing aside manifold concerns about the potential for violence along the way. The innocent explanations for Donald Trump's conduct seem virtually impossible to credit following the testimony we have seen, said Joshua Matz, who served as a lawyer for House Democrats during both of Mr. Trump's impeachment trials in the Senate. At the very least, they powerfully shift the burden to Trump and his defenders to offer evidence that he did not act with a corrupt, criminal state of mind. And so nearly 2.5 centuries after the 13 American colonies declared independence from an unelected king, the nation is left weighing a somber new view of the fragility of its democracy and the question of what, if anything, could and should be done about it. To the extent that there may be a turning point in that debate, Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony proved decisive for some who had been willing to give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt or had been uncertain that the committee had gathered enough evidence about the former president's state of mind. Solomon Weisenberg, a former deputy independent counsel under Ken Starr, called her account the smoking gun, making a case for his criminal culpability on seditious conspiracy charges. Mick Mulvaney, who served as Donald Trump's third White House chief of staff, said he had been defending him, but learning that Mr. Trump knew some in the crowd were armed and still encouraged it to go to the Capitol certainly changes my mind, he told Fox News Channel. David French, a conservative critic of Donald Trump, had been skeptical the committee would produce sufficient evidence, but Cassidy Hutchinson's sworn testimony closes a gap in the criminal case against Donald Trump, he wrote on The Dispatch, a conservative website. Two law professors, Alan Rosenstein of the University of Minnesota and Jed Handelsman Sugarman of Fordham University, likewise opposed prosecution until seeing Ms. Hutchinson writing on the Lawfare blog that she changed their minds because she provided proof of intent. The hearings, which will continue after Congress returns on 11th of July from its holiday recess, have presented only the prosecution's side of the story. With Donald Trump's acquiescence, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Republican leader, opted against appointing anyone to the Select Committee after Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected a couple of his original selections, leaving the panel composed entirely of Democrats and just two Republicans deeply critical of the former president. Neither Cassidy Hutchinson nor any of the other witnesses who have testified have been cross-examined. Their testimony has often been presented in short edited clips rather than in their entirety, and no contrary testimony has been offered publicly. In a courtroom, if it ever came to that, the case against Donald Trump would be tested, as it has not been so far. The committee's presentation has been a purely political exercise, deceptively edited, said Jason Miller, who served as a political advisor to Donald Trump during and after the election. Yet even outside the confines of the hearing room, Mr. Miller and others in Donald Trump's camp have mainly attacked the committee or tried to chip away at pieces of the testimony rather than produce much of a defense of the former president's actions or an alternate explanation of his state of mind. In his social media posts, Donald Trump denied asking the armed supporters to be allowed at his rally. Who would ever want that, he wrote, not me. He focused more on his energy on castigating Cassidy Hutchinson in scathing personal terms and concentrated on one small aspect of her testimony, namely whether he lunged at the wheel of his presidential vehicle when his Secret Service detail refused to take him to the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. Throughout his time in politics, Donald Trump has survived one scandal after another, in part because people in the authority felt unable to read his mind. Investigators were not sure they could definitively prove that he intended to break the law when he authorized hush money to silence a film actress, or when he provided false valuations of his properties to lenders, or when he sought to impede the inquiry into Russia's election interference. Fact-checkers similarly documented tens of thousands of false statements he made while in office, but were reluctant to declare that he knowingly lied. He learned from Dad, Norman Vincent Peale, and especially Roy Cohn, that you can get away with almost anything if you never back down and insist long enough and loud enough that you're right. And he held onto that right up to the final ride. Back to the White House, said Gwenda Blair, his biographer, referring in turn to Fred Trump, the author of The Power of Positive Thinking, and Senator Joseph McCarthy's red-baiting chief counsel, who became a mentor to Donald Trump. For Mr. Trump, he was being completely consistent with the way he was acted his entire life. Anthony Scaramucci, a longtime associate who served briefly in the White House before breaking with Donald Trump, has talked in the past about Mr. Trump's power to interpret reality in whatever way suited him. But Mr. Scaramucci said He had concluded that Mr. Trump understood perfectly well that the election was not stolen and that his actions on 6th of January 2021 to overturn it were illegitimate. "I do believe that President Trump knows that the whole thing that he is doing is a ruse," said Mr. Scaramucci. On more than one occasion throughout the campaign in 2016, he would turn to me and others and say funny things like, "Why can't people realize what you guys realize about me? That I'm play-acting and full of it at least 50% of the time." That sort of joking. So he knows that this is all a lie. What the hearings have demonstrated, with an array of witnesses drawn almost entirely from the president's own allies and advisers, is that if Donald Trump did not know, he certainly had every reason to. One advisor after another, including two successive attorney generals and multiple campaign officials and lawyers, told him there was no there, as one put it, when it came to widespread election fraud. Yet he persisted in spinning wild tales of conspiracies. While Attorney General Merrick Garland must weigh many factors before deciding whether to bring a case, including whether it is in the national interest to charge a former president, Cassidy Hutchinson's account of Donald Trump's actions leading up to and on 6th of January provided the building blocks for a possible prosecution by demonstrating that he and his advisers understood perfectly well they were playing with fire. While Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, claimed in a memoir that Donald Trump had only been speaking metaphorically when he vowed to march to the Capitol. In fact, he had discussed it for days. Cassidy Hutchinson first learned of the plan on 2nd of January 2021, when Rudolph Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, told her Mr. Trump would go to the Capitol and would look powerful. Alarmed, she found Mark Meadows, her boss. "It sounds like we're going to the Capitol," she said. Mr. Meadows did not look up from his phone, but made clear he understood the peril. "Things might get real, real bad on 6th of January," she remembered him telling her. On the morning of 6th of January, she listened as Mark Meadows was warned that some Trump supporters gathering at the rally on the Ellipse had weapons with them. Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, warned that Donald Trump should not go to the Capitol. "We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if we make that movement happen," he said, according to Cassidy Hutchinson. Donald Trump was undaunted, though. Waiting in a tent to address the crowd, he brushed off worries about violence. He criticized the Secret Service for screening supporters with magnetometers, standard procedure for a presidential event, and demanded that they be removed. "They're not here to hurt me," he said. "Take the mags away. Let my people in." Addressing the crowd, he declared that he would go with them to the Capitol, but when he climbed into his armored vehicle, the Secret Service officials refused to take him, citing his own security. According to what Ms. Hutchinson said, she was later told by Anthony Ornato, a deputy White House chief of staff, that Mr. Trump erupted in rage and demanded to go to the Capitol. They returned to the White House instead, where Donald Trump stewed about being thwarted. And he watched television images of his supporters rampaging through the Capitol. He agreed with those in the crowd calling on Mike Pence to be hanged. Indeed, according to Ms. Hutchinson's testimony, he was on the side of the mob. As she heard Mark Meadows put it, he doesn't think they're doing anything wrong.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.